We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Lots to cover, so let's dive in, starting with local and the ACLU.
Yeah, the ACLU and 34 other community groups sent a six-page letter to the Department of Justice this week, asking them to investigate the Seattle Police Department, and it's regarding whether the Seattle Police have violated the civil rights of suspects, especially minority suspects, after several incidents have been in the media lately, including the shooting of Native American woodcarver John T. Williams, and the videotape of a Latino man being stomped on and being sworn at by a, you know, a racial slur by a police officer, the video of an African American teen being kicked multiple times after surrendering to an undercover policeman, and it turns out the punching of an African American teenage girl during a jaywalking incident, and something we're just hearing about, the beating of a man in a police department lobby when he came to pick up his after being released from arrest and going back to pick up some of his things that were taken from him when he was arrested. And a lot of these were captured on videotape. What was interesting to me is the president of the Seattle Police Guild, Rich O'Neill, saying that these videotaped incidents have been blown all out of proportion and are really examples of appropriate force, which really gives you an idea of what the main problem is here when you have the president of the police guild telling cops that these incidents are okay.
And not only okay, but should be emulated.
Yeah. So at this point, the Department of Justice, having received that letter, will now decide whether or not to open a preliminary inquiry that could eventually, if they decide to, lead to a full investigation. As of September, the Department of Justice was investigating about 17 different police departments around the country.
Yeah, and let's be clear about this. This has been an ongoing pattern with the Seattle Police Officers Guild that, for example, when you have the use of lethal force, that officer often winds up getting the Officer of the Month award from the police union. It's a sort of thing where the actual culture within the police officers' rank and file themselves is one of using excessive force. And until that culture is challenged and overturned, you're going to continue to have these problems. And that kind of leadership has to come from the top as well as from the officers of the police guild. And neither of those has been happening.
Yeah. Instead, they've been getting the message from Deputy Chief Kimmerer, who said a couple of weeks ago, yeah, that the main problem is the fact they're being caught on videotape, not that they're actually doing these things that are inappropriate use of force.
All right. Moving on. Speaking of from the top, cuts coming down from the top.
Yeah, Governor Chris Gregoire this week announced that the state will suspend grants to 36 community health groups and clinics that serve nearly a million low-income people in this state. And what's shocking to me is that the cuts to these community health clinics will equal about $5.5 million, and that's a very, very tiny amount of the total hole in the budget. And it's also a false economy. I mean, if these clinics close, then those people will end up using a lot more emergency services, going to hospitals, and eventually costing the state and taxpayers and people with health insurance a lot more money than the little bit of money that we're spending on the community health clinics, which is really a big value if you think about that. $5.5 million, that's about $6 per patient, considering the number of people they serve. That's a real bargain. And yet cutting that amount of money only closes maybe 1.5% of the huge budget hole in the state's budget.
We're going to be talking about this a lot more in the weeks to come as the state legislative session convenes after the first of the year, because most of the proposals for closing the state's budget gap that have been floated so far involve cutting services to the poor. That doesn't make up that much of the budget anymore, because so much of those services have already been cut over previous budget shortfalls. But the really big ticket items on the table aren't being addressed. Things like the massive tax loopholes, any kind of generation of new revenue that might take place. All that that's being taken off the table. Certainly, a lot of the major expenses also are being taken off the table, like public safety. That leaves you with social services, which is going to impact the poorest people the hardest. Even though those services are the ones that the greatest demand for in a bad economy.
Right now, Gregoire is suggesting some possible cuts the legislature could make in January. That includes eliminating the basic health plan, which is insurance for the state's poor who can't get insurance through their employers or are self-employed and can't afford to buy insurance, that's only $46.3 million. I mean, the hole in the deficit is the deficit in the budget is $385 million this year. It's going to be about $5.7 billion for the next biennium. And cutting out $46.3 million, you know, by not providing insurance to the state's poor, that's not going to close that hole. These are very tiny cuts, and they're not, and the legislature and the governor are not talking about the real solutions, like maybe closing some B&O tax exemptions for big businesses like the state's tech industry, or for Boeing, which is not even a Seattle corporation anymore. It's a Chicago corporation, yet they still get some major tax breaks in this state. And, of course, they're not talking about what would really help close the budget deficit, which would be a raise in tax revenue. That's completely off the table.
Yeah. And
it shouldn't be.
For example, Microsoft got a new tax break that'll pass legislative session worth $1 billion. That's not even being discussed. Little revisited.
Yeah. I mean, they want to cut $46.3 million for the basic health plan. They want to cut out state disability entirely. These are people who are completely unemployable, people who are disabled or have mental health issues, who will never be able to get a job, and yet they want to take away the tiny amount of benefits for them, which amount to about $55.6 million, just a tiny amount of the $5.7 billion gap in the budget, and yet they want to give $1 billion to Microsoft. That's, to me, that's just incredible.
All right, moving on to national, starting with Portland and the FBI office down there.
Oh yeah, the Portland teenage terrorist Mohammed Osman Mohammed, who was arrested by the FBI while attempting to set off a car bomb at a Christmas tree lighting ceremony in Portland this past week. Well, it turns out that this kid, 19 years old now, but he's been followed by the FBI for over a year. He was groomed, financed, supplied by FBI undercover agents undergoing a sting operation. They mapped out a plan for him. They even had cops hold a parking space for him so that he could park the car with the fake bomb in it. They even helped him build the fake bomb. I mean, they literally did everything for him. They provided financing for this kid. It's almost like, for example, if I were to say, oh, you know, I just had a fight with one of my ex-boyfriends. He makes me so mad, I'd like to kill him. And someone says to me, okay, here's a gun, here's the bullets, here's how to fire. Let me help you with your target practice. Oh, here's where he lives now. Here's his schedule. Here's the best times to attack him. Here, let me help you
be a glorious martyr that will be elevated by people around the world if you do it, if you just kill your boyfriend.
Yeah, and here's the money to do it. I mean, it's just insane. It is clearly entrapment. And as Jav told me, we were discussing this on the phone last night, he said, yeah, how many teenagers have violent fantasies? Quite a few of them, you know, but not everyone has the FBI helping them realize their dreams. To that extent, you know, not every teenager has a major government agency out there helping them to realize their violent fantasies. It's just incredible.
And it also makes you wonder, you know, if this had been, you know, a white kid from the suburbs as opposed to a Somali immigrant, would the FBI, upon, you know, reading his email or whatever it was that tipped him off, say, oh, well, he'll grow out of it? Probably they would have. Probably they would not have, you know, spent untold amounts of money to try and entrap him into this spot.
Yeah, or you know, if he'd been a white kid, they would have said, "Gosh, why don't we recruit him for the military?" Seriously,
or the FBI.
Seriously, if he'd been a lower middle class white kid, they would have said, "Perfect for the military."
Yeah, then he can kill all the people he wants.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Moving on, developments this week with Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Yeah, this week the Pentagon issued its widely anticipated report on whether or not it would be a problem to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. After a 9-month-long study, they finally came to the conclusion that, no, it wouldn't make much of a difference if you repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell. They surveyed most of the personnel within the military, and they found that, gosh, you know, these folks think that they're already serving with gays and lesbians and that it wouldn't be a major impact if those people could be out in the military.
Yeah, specifically 70% of service members believing that the impact would be either positive, mixed, or of no consequence at all. That's a staggering mandate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and immediately, of course, the bigots lined up to fight this. Senator John McCain leading the charge. basically said the day the report was released, well, I just have to see some of the details first. And he sat down and figured out, well, the problem here is not that they surveyed everybody in the military. The problem is that they didn't narrow the survey down to combat units only. In McCain's mind, if they had surveyed only combat units, then the results would have been different. He said,
you know, the manly men.
Yes, and women. And oh no, we can't talk about manly women. That's prohibited. But no, he said he made an astounding comment by saying that if these young people were mature enough to fight and die for the United States, then they ought to be free of any of having to deal with gay people. My response to that is, gosh, if these kids are mature enough to fight and die for their country, they're certainly mature enough to get along with everybody in their unit, regardless of their sexual orientation.
And of course, a certain percentage of those service people are you know, mature enough to be fighting and dying for their country while they're gay.
Yes,
so,
many of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, McCain has been walking this back for a while. I mean, he was talking during the presidential campaign a couple of years ago about, well, I wouldn't support the repeal of it until the military leadership is in support of it. Well, the military leadership came out in support of it last year. Well, then it was, well, we have to wait and see the results of the study. Well, then the study came out. And that was when we were walking that back and saying that the wrong people were surveyed. And, you know, it's...
it doesn't get more ridiculous.
Clearly, this is a man who cannot accept yes for an answer.
Yeah.
Put it that way.
Yeah.
All right, moving on. Sugar beets.
Yeah, a federal U.S. District Court judge in San Francisco this week ordered Monsanto to destroy 256 acres of genetically engineered sugar beets. Those beets were being grown to provide seeds for the 2012 sugar beet crop. Now, those sugar beets are genetically engineered to resist the effects of Roundup, which is a weed killer. And the judge said that, quote, there's a significant risk that the plantings pursuant to permits will cause environmental harm by contaminating or cross-pollinating other crops, especially organic crops. Roundup-ready sugar beets have been planted on over 1 million acres in the United States and in two Canadian provinces. About 95% of the total 2010 crop are genetically engineered sugar beets from Monsanto and other seed companies, and more than half the sugar in the U.S. food supply is from genetically engineered sugar beets. The USDA has been tasked with preparing an environmental impact statement on the effects of genetically modified sugar beets on the entire crop and on the environment, but it's been dragging its feet. It's still preparing that statement, and it won't be done until May 2012, and yet the USDA went ahead and gave Monsanto and other companies the okay to sell these on the market and to promote them to farmers. Judge White, the judge who made this ruling, said that the USDA didn't adequately consider the environmental impact before allowing the beets to be sold, which is clearly and obviously true. And, of course, now the USDA says, as well as Monsanto said, that they will try to appeal his ruling.
All right, moving on. And related to that, food safety.
Yeah, this week the Senate passed a food safety bill, finally. The House of Representatives passed this bill more than a year ago. Currently, about 5,000 people in the U.S. die from foodborne illnesses every year. And the annual cost of treatment is about $152 billion versus the cost to enforce the new rules, which would be about $300 million. The new rules would strengthen the FDA so that it can inspect farms and facilities before an outbreak occurs. And for the first time, the FDA will be able to inspect imported food. In the past, less than 1 pound in a million of imported food was ever inspected. That's pretty terrible if you consider that about 3/4 of the seafood we eat in this nation is imported.
Yeah, and bear in mind, this is the first major overhaul of food safety regulations since the 1930s. It's simply remarkable more people haven't died. At the same time, you had a number of Republicans who voted against food safety. And
bill was held up by Senator Tom Coburn, a Republican from Oklahoma, basically single-handedly kept the Senate from doing any votes on this bill for the last year.
Yeah, and since it still has to go back to conference committee because the Senate, the House and the Senate versions are different, there's certainly plenty of room for this to be held up again in the new legislative session coming up in January.
Yeah, so call your senators and put the heat on them to pass this bill as soon as possible.
All right. Well, speaking of held up, President Obama this week met with Republicans.
Yeah, we had another in Obama's seemingly endless series of cumbia moments with congressional Republicans this week, meeting together and talking about the glories of bipartisanship. And lo and behold, less than 24 hours later, here's Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader for the Republicans, saying that during the lame duck session, if Bush's tax cuts for the wealthy are not extended, nothing else will be allowed to pass in the Senate during the lame duck session. And of course, during the new session that comes in January, it'll be that much more difficult to get anything passed due to the change in composition of the new Congress. So we had yet another one of these moments where Obama is talking about how wonderful it will be that everybody gets along and sharing purpose and all these good things, and then he turns around and gets stabbed in the back and shrugs. And I love this quote from, I believe it was the New York Times coverage of it. Obama did not think Mr. McConnell's threat broke the spirit of bipartisanship that the president expressed after his meeting with Republican congressional leaders on Tuesday. Well, that just pretty much tells you everything that you need to know about the leadership in the White House right now. Meanwhile, speaking of Republicans not doing things, the Presidential Commission came out this week and reported that the U.S. needs to more than triple its spending on green energy research, development, and demonstration projects from about $5 billion now to $16 billion in the future. In order to try and keep moment, not just with the Chinese, but also with the Japanese, Koreans, and any number of our European allies, the U.S. basically falling behind the rest of the developed world entirely when it comes to green energy. And Stephen Chu, the Department of Energy Secretary, saying that this is a Sputnik moment. Well, yes, if you had half of Congress controlled by people beholden to the horse and carriage industry and determined not to do anything, it would make President Eisenhower look good. And if we didn't believe that the moon, that
even exists,
well, or that, you know, you might get green cheese all over the spacecraft. I mean, this is the sort of politics that we have right now, and it's very, very discouraging for being able to meet the challenges of the 21st
century. This is a major issue in Europe, where they're saying that where governments are worrying, gosh, we're being left behind by China and the Far East in terms of green energy. We're getting left out of the next big boom in the economy by not investing in green energy and not providing incentives for its growth. Here in the United States, we're falling even behind Europe in that regard.
All right. Well, speaking of energy and the environment, developments this week involving deepwater drilling.
Yeah, the Obama administration reversing its March decision to allow deepwater drilling in previously untouched areas off the Gulf Coast of Florida and along the East Coast from Florida to Delaware. And I love the rationale from the Obama administration talking about how it changed its mind from its March deregulation of deepwater drilling due to weaknesses in federal regulations revealed by the deepwater drilling disaster. Of course, the deepwater drilling disaster was last April, and it was pretty apparent to anybody who was watching at the time what the gaps in those regulations were. It needn't have taken another 8 months for that to be sussed out.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on to the developments with the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, the Federal Reserve released documents this week on 21,000 transactions it's made in the last 2 years to deal with the economic downturn. And that release of documents was mandated by Congress because the Fed didn't want to release the documents. It turns out from those documents that the Fed has given some of the biggest help for, I guess, some of the biggest recipients of the Fed's low or no interest loans and other aid were European banks and foreign governments. Barclays Bank of Britain was the biggest cumulative borrower from the term auction facility, which made 1 to 3 month loans to banks for very, very low or no interest. It borrowed $232 billion from the Fed, a British bank. Bank of Scotland and RBS were also big borrowers. Societe Generale of France, Dresdner Bank of Germany, and Bayerische Landesbank. Dexia of Belgium, all seven of those were among the top 10 users of the term asset auction facility. The biggest seller of commercial paper to the Fed's commercial paper funding facility, which bought illiquid short-term loans, basically junk loans from other banks, was UBS of Switzerland, followed by AIG. We think of AIG as the biggest problem for the Fed and something that they're not gonna be able to make money off of the deals that they did for AIG. Well, UBS of Switzerland was literally the biggest customer in terms of the commercial paper funding facility. But five of the top 10 users of that facility were European banks. The Fed also helped out the central banks of Australia, Denmark, Mexico, Norway, Sweden, Switzerland, South Korea, Britain, and Japan, and insurers and pension funds in Sweden and South Korea. The Fed literally served as the world's central bank during the 18 months from late 2008 through 2009. So this is more evidence of how interlocked the national economies are in this big global financial system. What's very interesting to me is that at the time these transactions were made, people were asking, economists and media people were asking the Fed, so what are you doing? Who are you loaning money to? Give us information. And the Fed said, no, we are keeping this secret in order to help the economy. They kept all the secret because if they had said anything at the time, if anyone had been able to tell exactly the extent to which the problem had spread around the world and the number of foreign banks and governments lining up to take money from the United States Federal Reserve, I think it would have brought a much bigger collapse to the system than it did.
So when they're talking about the economy, I'd always assume they were talking about the U.S. economy.
No, they were talking about the world economy. The Fed was literally propping up the entire global financial system.
And where does that money come from?
The Federal Reserve was literally
printing
money, yeah, to prop up the global financial system, to provide liquidity to Europe, to the Far East, to the United States. It turns out the only country, it seems to me, the only large nation not lining up for a handout was China, and that's because China owns most of our government debt.
Yeah. And it's also interesting, of course, that
they have cash.
It's also interesting, of course, that the different governments were using that money very differently than the U.S. money was, than the U.S. government was. So that, for example, people who were being hurt, ordinary homeowners, for example, who were being hurt by the real estate bubble and various other things, were getting assistance in other parts of the world. They were not getting assistance in the U.S.
Yeah. But what's interesting to me is, you know, we think of the United States banks being, you know, very free with lending money to anybody who wanted it, regardless of whether they qualified for loans. Well, it turns out because United States banks were raking in the dough doing that in fees and in interest from people who couldn't afford to make payments, eventually couldn't afford to make the payments on their loans, it turns out that European banks and banks all over the world looked at that and said, gosh, why aren't we in on that scam? Let's do that too. And that's exactly what they did.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's move on. International Nigeria.
Yeah, Nigeria said this week that it is thinking about suing Dick Cheney. The KBR, which formerly was a part of Halliburton, pled guilty last year to charges that it had paid $180 million in bribes from 1994 to 2004 to Nigerian officials so it could get $6 billion in contracts for natural gas production in Nigeria. Dick Cheney was CEO of Halliburton from 1995 to 2000 during five of those years. So the Nigerian government is now considering filing charges against Dick Cheney in that bribery case.
I think everybody should consider suing Dick Cheney. I mean, probably there's something somewhere in his past that would merit it.
Yeah,
exactly. No matter who you are.
All right, moving on. WikiLeaks developments this week, more.
Yeah, the WikiLeaks with a new massive dump of over 250,000 dispatches from the U.S. State Department, and the as Counterspin mentioned in the 8 o'clock segment, the U.S. response to this has been very similar to what it's been for past WikiLeaks documents. Don't look here, look over there at how evil WikiLeaks is. But WikiLeaks, it really is very similar to the ACLU in terms of being an absolutist organization around freedom of information. They really couldn't. I mean, it would open up a whole new can of worms if they served as a gatekeeper and said, well, these are worthy of being released. These are not worthy of being released. So you wind up with this massive dump of documents. And what it reveals basically is that the U.S. You know, in addition to a lot of the sort of, you know, pedestrian affairs of international diplomacy and international gossip and whatnot, is still really working, backwards to try and, well, number one, to try and appease the various dictatorships that it has alliances with throughout the Middle East, but also that it is working very hard to interfere in the domestic affairs of countries all around the world, and that this really has not been the occasion for much notice in U.S. media coverage. It's like that's supposed to be the natural course of affairs.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Some of the things in these cables are things that we've heard about little bits of in the press, but they haven't been big stories until now. One of them being that diplomats at the State Department are engaging in human intelligence gathering, the sort of thing that the CIA is traditionally supposed to do, but apparently doesn't do anymore because the CIA is concentrated on covert operations, particularly bombing people with aerial drones in certain parts of the world, like Pakistan and Afghanistan and Somalia and Yemen and places like that. In addition, what was interesting to me is that you had a lot of talk between the U.S. and the South Korean government about the eventual collapse of the North Korean government, almost a gleeful rubbing of hands saying, when is it going to happen? It's going to happen soon. We better be prepared. It also came out this week, too.
And, of course, there's no context there. They've probably been saying that for the last 60 years.
Well, they're apparently saying it more now. And it turns out we learned this week as well that South Korea fired first when it came to the attack by North Korea on Pyongyang Island in South Korea, that South Korea was conducting a little test of its artillery there. The South Korean government said, well, yeah, we were firing first, but we weren't firing at North Korea. We were just firing in their general vicinity.
Just very close to them.
Yeah, just sort of almost at them, but not quite.
Yeah. And of course, North Korea made this claim immediately, and everybody just dismissed it out of hand and said, yeah, right.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on. Speaking of South Korea, developments this week with South Korea and the U.S. and trade.
Yeah, the largest free trade agreement since NAFTA was reached with South Korea this week. The first major free trade agreement of the Obama administration. And for those people who thought that Barack Obama, once in office, would not be as amenable to free trade agreements as his predecessors were, because of course you remember his making some noises about needing to amend NAFTA and things like that on the campaign trail. Well, you also remember that there was a minor kerfuffle during the campaign season in 2008 about an aide of his meeting with the conservative Canadian government and saying, oh no, that's just for public consumption. We don't really have any objections to free trade whatsoever. Well, it turns out now, I guess it was that secret back channel communication that was more a glimpse into the real policy priorities of Barack Obama, not what was being said for public consumption.
Right. And finally, in 30 seconds, Iran.
Not sure I can do it in 30 seconds,
right,
but we'll try. One leading nuclear scientist was assassinated, another seriously injured in separate car bombings this week in Tehran. And of course, that sounds a lot like covert ops when it's, you know, leading scientists for their nuclear program. And not surprisingly, the Iranian government blamed it on Israel and the United States and covert ops. But what was really interesting was the U.S. media coverage of it, or rather the complete lack thereof. The only major article on it anywhere in the U.S. was in the Washington Post, which gave equal weight to opposition group claims that it was the Iranian government itself who had assassinated the nuclear scientist. Whereas if you looked at the European press and the British press, they not only gave the very helpful context that both the United States and Israel have admitted publicly to doing covert ops of these types within Iran, which is something the Post article did not mention, but also explicitly deconstructed and rejected as there being no evidence for the opposition claims of being for the Iranian government behind it, because the Iranian government wouldn't waste valuable scientific assets like that. They would simply put them under house arrest or otherwise detain them. They wouldn't assassinate them, and certainly not in broad daylight. So once again, covert ops going on in Iran, even as we learn of all these WikiLeaks diplomatic pressures from governments all over the region wanting the U.S. to launch more aggressive military strikes against Iran. We're already at war with them.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is at www.eatthestate.org. And we are, as we speak, we have our little minions in back rooms that are starting to compile our most overhyped and underreported stories of 2010 list. So if you have suggestions for that, either stories that you thought got way too much attention that it should have or didn't get nearly enough attention, send your suggestions to editorial@eatthestate.org.